help finding it. Find Proverbs. It's the book after Proverbs. Proverbs follows Psalms. So Ecclesiastes chapter 5. We're going to be looking at verses 8 through 12 today, but looking more closely, focusing on verses 8 through 9. I read an article the other day, and it was titled, Three Things People Really Should Not Be Talking About. And the article begins with this. I don't know about you, but when I was younger, my parents always taught me to not discuss three things with other people. And you probably already have in mind what those three things might be. Money, religion, and by process of elimination, politics. Right? Those are the three things that, according to this author, you don't talk to other people about. He goes on to say, these days, people don't seem to understand the social norm we hopefully all once learned. Of course, people do tend to avoid these topics in certain places because of the controversy they can generate. And why are they controversial? Why are they contentious? Well, any number of reasons, but one, these topics address what we fundamentally believe about our origin, our purpose, our destiny. And out of that, out of our religion, our faith, how should we handle money? How should we handle politics? They're controversial because they're meaningful. They're significant topics. They're significant beliefs, faiths, attitudes. And of course, they're contentious because we have a lot of different opinions about what we should believe. Well, today and next week, I have the privilege of doing what many maybe avoid, and that is to talk about money, religion, and politics. More accurately, preach about these three topics. And so today we will cover all three, but really with a special emphasis on the last two, that is religion or our faith, our beliefs, and politics. And then next week we'll focus more specifically on money or wealth. And my prayer for us today is that the Holy Spirit would use His word to challenge us on our attitudes, specifically our attitudes towards the oppressed and towards the powerful. That is the focus of verses 8 through 9 in Ecclesiastes 5, where the writer, who often refers to himself as the preacher, traditionally known to be Solomon, who would then be the king of Israel, that is what he describes. He describes the exploitation of the poor, and specifically the exploitation of the poor for something, as we'll see, especially in these verses to come, for wealth. And they're exploited by a certain group of people. They're exploited by government officials. And it's as though we're getting an insider account on the workings, or at least the potential workings, of the government towards its people or towards other people. As we'll see, the reality of oppression it's as much true today as it was true in biblical times. And thankfully, God's word provides us an answer to the question, how should we respond to the oppressed, and how should we respond to the powerful? Let's pick up the reading then in verse 8. Again, we'll read verses 8 through 12. We'll especially look at verses 8 through 9 today. It's Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 8. God's word says, if you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. When I read the beginning of the verse, I'm immediately struck by just the word if. If you see in a province oppression, that's a tragic observation. The oppression of the poor. And I'm curious as to, well, how often does this occur? Or maybe you could say it differently. I just want to know, how often should I be on the lookout for this? How often should I be prepared or anticipate needing to heed the advice of the preacher? And when we're dealing with what is, as we'll especially talk about later, sort of an obscure, it's a proverbial text, a bit difficult to understand, we really want to understand then the context of Ecclesiastes. That is, does the preacher, does Solomon talk about this topic elsewhere? And then we want to look to the entirety of God's word to see what it has to say about this topic. Well, when we survey Ecclesiastes, we actually find that this is the third time that Solomon has talked about this topic of oppression. First, in chapter 3, verse 16, he observes that where there should be justice, where that should exist, that there's actually wickedness. And he says where there should be righteousness, he says there is also wickedness. The second time is in chapter 4, verse 1, where the preacher writes this. He writes, "Again, I saw all the oppression that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them." Solomon doesn't seem to think that this is a rare situation. This rarely happens, but if it happens, this is how you might respond. In fact, God said that the kings would exploit the people for personal gain. So do you remember in 1 Samuel when the people of Israel, they demand of Samuel a king, and they say, "We want a king that's going to judge us like the rest of the nations." And God told Samuel he told them that they had rejected him. That is, the people had rejected God. Not Samuel. They had rejected him, God, because they rejected him, God, to be their king. And then he told Samuel, "Go ahead, obey their voice, obey their request, but I want you to tell them what the ways of the king will be like." So Samuel told them in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 10 through 18, how the king will do any number of things, including he'll take the people to plow his own ground and reap his own harvest, how he will take the best of their fields, he'll take a tenth of their harvest. He said how they will be slaves, among many, many other things. This is how the kings will respond. This is how they will treat their people. And actually, this is in some ways exactly what Solomon did to his own people. We read in 1 Kings chapter 12 how the people tried to convince or persuade Rehoboam, which is his son, Solomon's son, to lower the heavy taxation that Solomon had placed on the people. And so how does Rehoboam respond? Well, he told the people he was going to make their burdens even worse. The people say, "Hey, Rehoboam, king, the taxation of your father has been extreme and burdensome to the people. Will you consider lowering it?" And he goes and he consults with those who are wise, and then he goes and consults with this other group of people, and they tell him, those who are not wise, to, "No, don't back down from the people." And so he goes back and he says, "I'm going to increase your taxes," which ultimately then leads to the fracturing of the kingdom. And then once we have this kingdom that's divided, the northern and the southern kingdom, the northern goes on to have 20 kings in total. And how many of those kings does the Bible say acted righteously? How many of the 20 kings of the northern kingdom acted righteously? Zero. Not one of them acted righteously. And then we learn that of the southern kingdom, they also had 20 kings. And they do slightly better, but they don't even get into the majority. 8 of that 20 are said to have acted righteously, to have led their people well. And so, no, political oppression is not an if, but a when reality. And it was common in biblical times. And, of course, then it's also common in our time today. If we surveyed the history of human oppression by governments for wealth, that could be an entire college course in itself to survey over the time of our human history all the oppression that we see. It would take a great deal of time, but that's not necessary. We only have to consider a few recent examples to prove the point that oppression is a tragically common reality today. First, it's been common in socialistic or communistic countries pursuing communism or socialism. According to the book titled The Black Book of Communism, nearly 94 million people died in the 20th century at the hand of those governments that were socialistic or pursuing communistic ideology. 94. The number of Jews who died in the Holocaust was 6 million. And I don't share that to diminish the one with the other. I show it to provide some perspective, because of the Holocaust we say, never again. And we rightly say that. May that never again happen. And yet, how well do we understand the human cost of that oppression that happened in those countries during the 20th century? If you looked at Venezuela today, the people are in famine without food, and yet their president, Nicolas Maduro, has plenty. There was a picture that was released, I think it was Christmas 2018, and it was of a Christmas party with these government officials. It was in the place that is the highest court of law in Venezuela, and there was just plenty. Food all around, lavish, spare no cost, and yet the people are in famine. They don't have the basic needs. The reality is, though, that we, the United States, we're not immune, right, to oppression of the poor for wealth. There's no doubt we continue to feel the consequences of the horrid history of slavery, that institution that sought to oppress an entire group of people for the sake of wealth. Our democracy has been susceptible to political corruption. Around the turn of the 20th century, you had political bosses who ran cities through bribes, kickbacks, insider trading, any number of other things. Today, if you've been following the news, just really in the last few weeks, there's a popular story about an individual who's accused of sex trafficking who was previously given an unjust plea deal. Many suspect, of course, the result of that was brought about by his wealth, right? Brought about by his power. And later we'll talk about another example, and that is of immigration. Now, my point here is not necessarily to judge political or economic systems, though I certainly have an opinion on that. My point here is to simply show that the oppression of people for wealth is a regular occurrence. It's not an if, but it tragically is a when reality. And when it happens towards a class of people. We read that we will see the oppression of the poor. And in the immediate context, the understanding of that being those who lack wealth would certainly make sense, and I think that's absolutely included. The political powers oppress the poor to achieve wealth for themselves. But we need to ask ourselves, who are the poor? Who might else be included in that idea of the poor? I don't think we have to. I don't think it only refers to those who are financially poor. The word poor itself can also mean that something is deficient or it's lacking in something. Right? We tend to think of it as wealth. They lack in wealth. But it can mean any number of things, a quality, a possession, a characteristic. So, for example, Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount, he said that the poor in spirit are blessed. So these individuals, they had an awareness of their lack of ability to please God in their own flesh. They were deficient, they were lacking something, and that something was their own self-righteousness. They were poor in spirit. When thinking back to our biblical and contemporary examples of oppression, what do the oppressed lack? What are they deficient in? Well, first we can say that they, the oppressed, are lacking in earthly power. Solomon said that on the side of the oppressor was power, but the oppressed had no one to comfort them. They didn't have the earthly means. That is, they didn't have the connections. They didn't have the authority. They didn't have the stature to defend themselves against the powerful. And I would absolutely include here wealth as part of power. In our own country, there's no doubt that we have a sense of a dual justice system. It operates differently for those who are of power and those who are without power. It's how a sex trafficker, how an abuser of minors can get off with this unjust plea deal, but you're hard-pressed to talk yourself out of a speeding violation or a parking violation. The one has power, the one has wealth, the other does not. Second, the oppressed, we're considering the question of who are the poor. Second, the oppressed are lacking in acceptable beliefs. What I mean here by acceptable are those beliefs that are held by those in power, those who have the authority. So part of the death that I mentioned associated with those governments that were pursuing socialistic, communistic ideology, some of those were from famine, from starvation, but many, many of them were because they held different beliefs. They were killed for not having acceptable beliefs. One individual in 1918, part of Lenin's secret police, said this. Said, "We are not waging war against individuals." Not individuals. That's not our goal here. "We are exterminating the bourgeoisie as a class." So don't focus on individuals. Focus on people as a class. He says, "Do not look for evidence that the accused acted in word or deed against Soviet power." Here's the first question you should ask, he says. The first question should be, to what class does he belong? It is this that should determine his fate. The oppressed threatened the oppressors because they held views different from their own. Well, finally, the third characteristic, how we might understand those who are poor, is the oppressed are lacking in acceptable appearance. Again, acceptable is defined and enforced by the powerful. And so slavery in the United States oppressed the poor, oppressed those who didn't have acceptable appearance, those with dark skin. Certainly oppression based on appearance continued in the 20th century with segregation of public and private spaces. I think we could also argue that abortion is oppression of those who appear different. People classify babies in the mother's womb as less human or not human at all, entirely based on their stage of development. What about ageism? Right? The belief that those who are older are perhaps less deserving or not deserving of whatever it might be at all. And we tend to think of maybe healthcare in this context. There are at least three takeaways then for us from this passage. Two we're going to talk about today. One we'll consider next week. And the first comes from what we've already considered. The first is that we need to respond biblically to the oppressed. It means first that you must address your own dehumanizing attitudes towards the oppressed. It's when you classify people as less than human because of their possessions, their beliefs, or their appearance. So So, for example, you might use a pejorative to describe someone who looks different than you or someone who has different beliefs. And when you use those terms, you put them in a class of other that suggests that somehow they are less human than you, or perhaps they're less ideal than you. You might drive through a poor neighborhood and think to yourself, I would never live here, ever, purely on the basis of appearance. You don't know anything about the neighborhood, just but by the way it looks, I would never, ever consider living here. Now, I'm not saying that you should live there. I'm not saying that you must live there. But the disposition of your heart towards those who do live there, it is reflected in your thoughts and in your speech. What if being salt and light was the first thing on your mind when looking for a place to live? That I want to live somewhere where I can be salt, I can influence the community, and I want to be light. I want to be of help. I want to demonstrate God's grace as he's poured it onto my life than in this community. What if that was your first thought? How might that change the way you view those people who live in poor communities? And we could go on and on. None of us are immune to this way of thinking. None of us. The people, the context, the circumstances might vary, but we are all tempted to have these types of thoughts. And ultimately, the dehumanization of people is fundamentally the denial that all people are created in the image of God. That is the core of it. And if you can ignore this truth, if you can set it aside, not believe it, however it is, if you come to that point in which you ignore the fact that all people, every one of us, is created in the image of God, then you can easily classify people on the basis of their possessions, their beliefs, or their appearances. So I want to encourage you something to try, very, very simple. I'm not sure there will be anything more simple than this today in terms of my encouragement to you. Next time you're tempted to classify people and so then treat them differently, that's the logical outworking of that, when we classify people differently, start with this thought. This person is created in the image of God. That's it. Start with that premise. Start with that thought. When you go to the store, when you go to that store, maybe that store you tend to avoid, but for whatever reason you're pressed to go there, but normally you wouldn't because of maybe the people that go there, people who tend to go there, or whatever the circumstances might be. When you go to that store, when you go to your child's school, which you wish he or she was not in that school because of the type of people who attend that school, when you drive through that neighborhood in which when you go through it, you think, I would never live in this community. When you interact with that coworker, start with the premise that the people you're encouraging or encountering have the same worth in the sight of God as you because they are just as much created in his image. Because how we think about people, again, absolutely affects the way we treat people. When people are treated as different classes of humanity, less than fully human, or maybe not human at all, again, it's easier to subject them to, what we read, injustice and unrighteousness. This is what we read earlier in the passage. The oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness. Well, what is justice? What should we think of when we think of justice? You know, there's multiple aspects to it. It's multifaceted. But justice is, we can at least say, it's doing what is fair and equitable, equal. It's executing laws without partiality. We read in Deuteronomy 10, verses 17 through 18, that the Lord your God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God, who is not partial and takes no bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow and loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. In Exodus 23, verse 6, the law says that in a lawsuit, you must not deny justice to the poor. That is, you must not show partiality or favor to the poor. That much is probably clear. But you also don't show partiality to the poor, not to the rich, not to the poor. Now, if you've seen those statues of what we call Lady Justice, there's not just one Lady Justice. There's many of these statues. You've probably seen Lady Justice. She has a scale in one hand. She has a sword in the other, and she's blindfolded. And the scale represents the weighing of evidence. And the sword represents the punishment and the swiftness of that justice. And of course, then the blindfold represents impartiality. Lady Justice doesn't see rich. She doesn't see poor. She doesn't see classes. She weighs the evidence, the strength and the weakness of each, and then renders a decision. This is the personification of justice, Lady Justice. And I think it captures at least many aspects of justice then. It should not show partiality. It should be fair and it should be equitable. Well, what is righteousness? Righteousness is, at least here in this context, it's fulfilling the expectations in any relationship, whether that be God or that be our neighbor, other people. It's doing what is right to another party, especially as it is in the context of an agreement. The word righteousness often goes along with justice. We see it many, many times together. So just one example of many, we read in Leviticus 19, verse 15. It says, "You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor." We need to address, as I said earlier, we need to address any dehumanizing attitudes that we might have. But another aspect of this first takeaway is that we also need to address attitudes about justice and righteousness. Frequently, what we see is injustice and unrighteousness, especially from institutions such as government. So, for example, the sex trafficker gets the unjust plea deal because, again, he has the possessions to sway those who have the power to execute justice. Meanwhile, the victims are poor and discarded as unworthy of the same treatment or the same justice. Those in power have not fulfilled the expectations of such a position of authority to do justice and to do righteousness towards all people. And instead, they are swayed by that power, by that wealth, for personal gain. But what about the case of illegal immigrants? What about the case of migrants? I mean, think about our current inability to fairly manage the immigration of people into our country. Whether you are on the left, you are on the right, wherever it is that you are on this position, I think it's fair to say most, a majority certainly, would say it's not being handled well. Our country is not doing it well. Now, think about the consequences that reflect what we're talking about. We're talking about oppression of the poor for the benefit of those who are in power. What are some of the consequences? Well, for example, it allowed businesses to underpay these individuals who are not here legally. I read of a case recently, I'm sure it's not unique to them or to this time, of a cleaning crew that was being paid $5 an hour, working 60 hours a week. No benefits, no overtime. Who are they going to appeal to, right? They're here illegally. Being paid $5 an hour, working 60 hours a week. And this is one example, I'm sure, many, many, many more. That is injustice. That's not justice both with respect to our laws, and it's not justice with respect to those who are doing the work. This situation also incentivizes criminals to exploit the poor when trying to illegally cross the border. People are regularly abused, they are raped, they are killed as they are trying to make their way here. They pay people in the hopes of receiving aid to illegally cross the border. And many times, I'm sure you've heard of these horrific stories. Occasionally, at times, these people are locked in vehicles in the back of a truck. They're locked in, and they get to a point in the desert in which they're making that travel, and they are left there to die. Sometimes, in the way, in the course of trying to make it here, those whom they paid will extort them for additional funds as they are making their way here. These migrants pay incredible fees in the hope of receiving this aid, and occasionally just left for themselves. Well, it certainly also isn't fair. It's not equitable to disregard the laws of the government for those who are considered poor. We saw earlier that justice doesn't favor the poor or the rich, but shows equity and impartiality to all people. Doing righteousness here means finding ways to ensure that our fellow human beings, our neighbors, are not exploited while not disregarding our governing authorities. Now, look, this is an incredibly complex issue. I certainly recognize that. I don't pretend to have all the answers. But what I'm especially concerned about as a pastor is that our attitudes towards other people reflect our responsibility towards them as fellow image bearers of God. That is first and foremost my concern. What is the disposition of our heart? What is the attitude of ours towards these individuals who are image bearers of God? And so may it never be heard among us, among our church, among believers, that such people somehow deserve to be exploited. And I recognize we may not say it that way. They deserve to be exploited. We may not use those words. But when we hear of these situations, we may think, well, they shouldn't have been in that situation. Or that somehow their oppression is somehow, it's less horrific, it's less tragic, given the circumstances, than that of someone else because of their class. If you see the exploitation of people, any people, and your first thought is that reflects a sort of justice, then you have a false view of justice and a distorted view of righteousness. And I recognize this is a very heated topic, but it's a current topic, it's a relevant topic, and it's a really powerful one to consider to test our attitudes towards those who are the poor among us. And I hope what you've noticed is that I haven't offered a policy. Again, I have an opinion on that as well. But that's not my interest right now. My interest is your heart towards others. And what I have offered is that your positions should reflect that all people are created in the image of God, and this is a God who is a God of justice and righteousness. I think we also need to be realistic about how a situation like this can be exploited by people from all political parties, both sides of the aisle, for their own political gain. And when a situation like this, when we say it's an exploited situation, the only thing that's being exploited are those people. That's who's being exploited. I mentioned earlier that there are two takeaways to consider today from this passage. So the first is you must respond biblically to the oppressed. That's what we've been considering. What are our attitudes towards the oppressed? What are our attitudes about justice and righteousness? That's the first. The second comes from the remainder of verses 8 and 9. Which is, you must respond biblically to the powerful. And it begins with having biblical clarity on the nature of sin. There's a great deal of debate over this passage. That is how you translate it. And, of course, depending on how you translate it, is how you understand the meaning of it. Clearly, Solomon tells us how we are to respond to the oppression that we see. He says we are not to be amazed. That is clear. And why should we not be amazed? Well, political powers are watching out for each other. So the ESV, which I read earlier, says this: do not be amazed at the matter. And why? For the high official is watched by a higher official, and there are yet higher ones over them. Now, verse 9 is especially difficult. And if you look at the variety of translations, you'll see that immediately. If you just go through and you look at some of the different translations of verse 9, it will be immediately evident to you. But when we take into account what we've seen in Ecclesiastes with respect to oppression and the warning and reality of oppressive kings, right? We talked about the 40 kings, 0 in the northern, 8 in the southern. When we take all that into account, Ecclesiastes, what God had said to Samuel to tell the people, what came to fruition with the nature of the kings, when we consider all of this, the most likely meaning of this passage is that even the king is corrupt. The NLT says this: even the king milks the land for his own profit. That is, this corruption, this oppression, it goes right to the top of the bureaucracy, with everyone colluding with each other to oppress the poor for personal gain. So responding with a biblical attitude towards the powerful begins with biblical clarity on the nature of sin. When Adam and Eve, when they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they and the world radically changed. It's not as though we should look back on that and we say, boy, things were really good, but they're just moderately worse now, right? Boy, must have been pretty good back then. It's pretty good now. No, things radically changed. Everything changed. Nothing was the same. Hostility became the inclination of every human being towards both each other and God. And so, for example, instead of mutual love and peace between husband and wife, there's now an ongoing struggle for power. Where there should have been righteousness towards brother and sister, murder became a reality between family and neighbors. The rebellion of humanity towards God only continued, such that at every opportunity, man rejects God. There are none who are righteous. No one seeks after God. It's why we need to be delivered from our sin through Jesus Christ. Politician, bureaucrat, citizen, laborer, the poor, the rich, it makes no difference. The only hope for justice, the only hope for righteousness, is that people acknowledge their helpless condition and depend fully and only on Christ's death on their behalf. That is it. That is the only hope. Responding with a biblical attitude towards the powerful begins with understanding the nature and effect of sin on the life of every human being. The dehumanization of all people begins with a rejection of God as Lord and Creator. If there is no ultimate authority and no Creator, then man is not created in His image. And there's ultimately no one for whom you are accountable to. And so you need to have a sober clarity about the horrors of sin and the effects upon all of humanity. Only then can you understand why you should not be surprised by oppression. And only then will you know the solution both for yourself and for others and for the entirety of humanity, which is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Well, responding biblically to the powerful also means having a measured skepticism about government. This naturally flows from an understanding of the nature of sin and its effects on all of humanity. I probably don't need to tell you that politicians and bureaucrats are susceptible to the same condition, right? None of us are immune, including politicians, bureaucrats, elected officials. All of humanity is inclined towards evil. But the effects of that inclination are escalated when individuals have the means of pursuing greater evil. We know that the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. That's what the Apostle Paul tells us. And That is what we have seen with many of the examples that I've mentioned, both in the biblical times and our own contemporary times. The love of money can lead to great oppression when the oppressors have greater means of than that exploitation. And so when we take all of this together, everything we've said up to this point, it makes sense that we should not be surprised when we see it. If you see it, I've argued when you see it, it's not an if reality, it's a when reality. We should respond then to government or political powers with a measured skepticism. But what I have noticed, and it's certainly not unique to our time, is there is an attitude among many within Christianity that deliverance from injustice, from unrighteousness, will actually come through politicians. It will come through governments. Those who have this opinion, these individuals, they place an incredible amount of hope and trust in the government. When their particular party or their preferred candidate is elected in office, that city, that state, our nation, it's almost as if it's faultless. Their hopes are high. It seems as though justice and righteousness will reign. But the moment that party or that particular politician is replaced with the opposite, there's dejection, there's hopelessness, and pessimism for the future. But brother and sister in Christ, our hope, our joy, our peace, our confidence, it's not in government. It's not in any individually elected official. The government is only as good as those who run it. And those who run it are imperfect. And I say that because we're all imperfect. That's what we've said. We have to have biblical clarity on the nature and the effect of sin. And I'm seriously concerned when I see individuals for whom as much, if not, more caught up in the hope of a politician or a policy than the hope found in Jesus Christ. And it would seem at times that some think it more likely to see meaningful and lasting change through new laws than people coming to faith. So responding biblically to the powerful means recognizing their imperfections and being skeptical about what government can do. What should we expect from government? But I've chosen my words carefully. I've said a measure of skepticism. And so we see in Romans 13 that governing authorities, they are instituted by God to judge and punish the wicked. Governments have one means of enforcing authority, and that is through power. And that power should not be used for oppression, but for protecting the people. And we are to then be subject to the authorities, and we are to pray for them. Paul told Timothy that believers should offer prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings for kings and all who are in high positions, all in the government. So I'm not encouraging you to abandon the political system. I'm not encouraging you to abandon political involvement. Right? If you know my education background, I'm a chaplain. That's not my personal practice. That's not what I'm encouraging you to do. What I am encouraging you to do is to respond with a biblical perspective to the powerful, which includes a measure of skepticism based on the nature of humanity, the effects of sin, what government can do, should do, and also while seeking to improve these institutions. How can we be salt and light? Well, the last way we respond biblically to the powerful, that's what we've been considering. How do we respond biblically to the powerful? We've talked about how we respond biblically to the oppressed. How do we then respond biblically to the powerful? I've offered up we should have a sobriety about the nature of sin, a clarity about it. We should have a measured skepticism about government, what we should expect, why we shouldn't be surprised when we see the oppression of the poor. The last way we respond biblically then is by having our eternal hope in the true King. Political powers have been threatened by Jesus before his death. And amazingly, when you think about it, a person who is dead, they are even still threatened by Jesus Christ. He was falsely accused as someone who wanted to overthrow the government. In fact, he died among two other men charged with insurrection. Highly controlling governments today suppress Christianity because they fear it threatens the stability of the state. They don't realize that Jesus did not come to set up an earthly kingdom in his first coming. Jesus' kingdom is not an earthly kingdom. He told Pilate as much. His followers are not overthrowing governments. Rather, they are living as subjects of earthly kingdoms while submitting themselves to the authority of Jesus Christ. So the only hope in the present for every manifestation of evil, including the oppression of the poor for wealth, for personal gain, every manifestation is new life in the true King. Redemption is found only in Jesus, who is working salvation through the church, not governments. That's not the institution that he chose to work through. He's working through the church. You know, as Americans, we are strongly opposed to any form of monarchy. Right? We are incredibly opposed, highly skeptical of any form of monarchy. We believe, of course, the best form of government to be one that at least distributes the power among multiple branches, right? High accountability, distributed power. It's because we're skeptical, right? We're skeptical of political power, of authority that resides in few individuals. And we saw earlier that of the 40 kings, right, that ruled the north and the south, only 8 were considered good. But when we take all that into account, we take our skepticism of monarchy, what we saw in the Old Testament, there is yet a time coming when we will rejoice over the supreme and sole rule of one. One person. A monarchy. And it will be a time when this tragedy of exploitation will be eliminated. That selfish desire for wealth, that root of all sorts of evils, it won't exist. Injustice, unrighteousness, it will be unknown. It won't even be spoken among us. It won't be a reality. Corrupt government officials, they'll have no place. No place to set up and to use their authority, to use their power to exploit the poor. One day God will, he's going to recreate the heavens and the earth. It will be a new heaven and a new earth where Jesus Christ will reign without contest. No competitors. And nothing better to compete with. He will reign supreme and solely. No one will thwart his plans. And no one will desire anything other than his rule. You should be dissatisfied with human attempts to rule. That should be dissatisfying. Don't be surprised when you see it. It's going to happen. This is why government officials at times exploit their positions. But that should not cause us to be hopeless. Jesus is presently reigning. He's presently leading the church here on earth. And us, his citizens of his kingdom, are acting as salt and light presently. But our hope, our eternal hope, is set on him who will be given the title King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Then you will be completely, you will be perfectly, you will be eternally satisfied with his divine rule. So we respond to the powerful not by disengaging, not overthrowing, but we respond with eternal hope in the true King. Would you pray with me?